Tonight's issue is disarmament, the arms race, and related matters. I'd like to urge us to keep the same touchstone and focus that we developed last evening in our exploration of the question of the relationship between Christianity and military service, that touchstone and focus being what is the meaning and the content of a Christian perspective on this question, a Christian understanding of the issues, and then to move further to explore, if we can, some of the things that Larry Rasmussen suggested that we might do during the announcements at dinner, namely a kind of turn toward action. What are we going to do in light of those circumstances that are before us? I've asked John Dellenbach to be with us again this evening. He was, if you'll recall, with us at the forum Monday evening and has been holding sessions here on a variety of topics. Those of you who weren't here Monday or haven't had a chance to meet him, I'll just say now that we've become friends in the 4 days that gotten to know one another, and he's served in the United States Congress for some 8 years. And I've asked him to be with us tonight, not simply for that reason, that he can make some opening remarks about disarmament and the arms race, but also because he's been the director of the Peace Corps and currently what's the commission to investigate the peace?
It's a commission of which I'm a member that is charged by Congress with the responsibility of recommending to the Congress and the President whether there should be a peace academy established by the United States.
Okay, so
the process of hearings on that.
Why don't you just take it away and make some introductory reflections on the arms race and your own world.
I'm trying to think what might be said soundly and helpfully to trigger off time together tonight. This one is difficult for me for a couple of reasons. It's difficult because it's so large. The field is so covering of issues on which you start down a major road, and I find myself going off on tangents. It's terribly complex. It's one where I personally find it easier to talk about than really to do, and I, of course, have wrestled with aspects of doing it because in all of the years when I was on the Hill, we had to vote on the budget, and the budget always included money for the military. We always voted for it, maybe with modifications, maybe to make cuts, maybe to make changes, but always in the final analysis, in the form where you either vote yes or no, I voted for the budget, for the military. You get off on one tangent into the question of the draft. And I hope that in the course of the evening Mark, we're going to be able to get input from some of those who are part of the family, the Holden family, who are of an age that not just their children will be impacted upon by whatever is done in this area, but they themselves will be impacted on it. And I would think it's important for our generations to hear from their generation what they see and feel and emotionalize on or intellectualize on at this time. But against that, let me say some things. One, in the Congress, the kind of money which is now being talked about for defense, and it's not considered a war budget, it's not considered a budget to conduct or be ready to conduct war. It's rather always, euphemistically or not, referred to as the defense budget. There are members of the Congress running across the range of the spectrum, the continuum. Again, we characterize ourselves when we characterize others in this category, but from conservative to liberal in this particular field. But I don't know any of them who really would say we should not spend any money for the military. Now, that's an interesting thing, because they sound, those some of those who are deeply involved in proposing cuts in the budget, not doing this or not doing that within the scope of military spending, I don't know any of them who would really say, even those who finally vote against the defense appropriation, as some do, I don't know any who would really say, if they were put on the line, say, look, do you think there ought to be not one dime spent for this? And I don't know any of the 535. I don't know them all that intimately and well at the present time, but I know nobody who would say, yes, I say there should be not one dime spent for this. And once you do that, once they've said there should be money spent for this, then in the discussion with them, there's a change in my mind between talking the purist against those who feel there should be money spent, and just everybody agreeing there should be spent, and they're merely talking about how much should be spent, or in what fields, or for what purposes money should be spent. The money that's talked about this year is absolutely astronomical. We're talking about in the range of $150 billion, somehow within the scope of the military. I think it was David Jones, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who recently said something about the expectations are that over the next five-year period, the federal government will spend in excess of $1 trillion for military. Now, those figures are astronomical, comes to mind, but that's almost not enough. Even when you look at that sky and really realize where it goes, that figure is a figure that defies comprehension, even within the scope of the kind of budgets that the United States has now moved to. You start talking about specific swimming. Most of the battles within the Congress relate to should or should there not be an increase in the carrier forces or in the sea-going forces? Should or should there not be additional monies spent for certain kinds of things? Should we be concentrating our spending on automatic weaponry of ballistic missiles? Should we be going into the anti-ballistic missile, the defense which was talked of some year, a few years ago? Should we go in for manned planes, and should we be increasing spending in that particular area? And you can go down the list of that kind of discussion. And there's where, on the floor of the Congress, most of the debate takes place. But you see, I repeat what I said before, there's very little of it where they say nothing, no money spent in this particular area. The question is, should the Christian have a different attitude about it? And maybe we can go from there on into a series of other things, but keeping our minds on what it is that Marx talked about as the touchstone, what should we as two challenges. One, apply the faith. Each of us has said in one form or another, I accept the Lord Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior, and I commit myself to following Him. What does that say to us about this view? And secondly, what am I going to do about it, I being each of us?
Okay. Thank you very much. Those are two questions. I'd like to hear two good ones, and I'd like to hear some responses back and forth to those. Don't all talk at once. Yeah.
I think there's two levels that a Christian might respond to it and could. One is, of course, there's the whole question of pacifism and whether you should support it at all. But even if you accept that, or you can accept the premise that there is such thing as a Christian soldier, still you have the stewardship question of how that money is best spent and whether that amount is appropriate in view of the other needs that are people-oriented in society. And I'd like to see some. I'm kind of concerned myself in the defense budget. I'm wondering how much of it is going for technologically sophisticated weaponry, more to keep defense contractors and engineering hobby shops going at the expense of programs that might not even be critical to the national defense. And I was wondering if Mr. Dollenbach could relay any opinions or insights that he might have on that in terms of the pressures to spend defense dollars for particular weapon systems versus conventional forces, and whether the input there is pressure from industry groups, or is the military, the Pentagon, the prime pressure point, and whether he feels that there is any, in his own mind, an imbalance.
Trying to make it brief, I said to Mary Jane as we were getting ready to walk down here, I said, I wish that I had a copy of the budget, but I really haven't contemplated this kind of a discussion when we came here, and so I clearly don't have one. But I wish that I had it so that we could look with some specificity at it, at some of the things, but we don't. And then in response to your question beyond that, one, there's an increasing amount of the money that is being spent on the military that is being spent on personnel-related portions of it. The advent of the volunteer army has brought with it very major increases in spending for just those people who serve in the military. The matter of veterans' pensions has just escalated very in major degree, and it costs just very substantial amounts of money to deal with those. The matter of pay scales and the question of what it is that senior officers get in addition to the men get. So there's a lot of it that's in that particular. The rest of it is sort of inextricably intertwined. When you talk about conventional weaponry and non-conventional nuclear types of weaponry, when you talk in terms of the involvement of the establishment with which those dollars are spent, they're inextricably intertwined. Those people and those instrumentalities, they come forward with they're talking new planes. So the plane manufacturers with whom the government has been facing its contracts, does some experimental work and comes in with ideas as to what it would do. And is it lobbying for those things, or is it responding to the input of the military command, in effect, to come up with things that are able in the technical weaponry field to deal with any weapons that the United States might have, any enemies, any wars that we might have? We shift in some of the discussions of, should the United States be able to fight a two-war fight on two fronts at the same time, as we did during World War II? That gets to be so terribly expensive that they're now talking in terms of 1.5 wars. Which sounds a little bit ridiculous on the surface, but what they're really talking about is one major war and then one brush fire, something or another. Isn't there a whole bunch of those things? They all add up. The military, if anybody's ever looked at what the Pentagon does, is in almost everything. It has a tremendous educational system that it runs that rivals most state education systems or much of what the federal government does. It has land ownerships that it has. It has involvements under that umbrella, in field after field after field, and they're all mixed up together.
Okay, let me Before taking the next question, remind you all and myself of the rule I instituted on Monday, which is that when we begin to talk, as soon as I see a hand while someone's talking, then I'll notify that person they've got 30 seconds, and then you wind up what you're going to say and so on, so that we can increase the numbers of people who can participate. And for my 30 seconds, I just want to suggest that we not get too wrapped up in the technical matters of proportions of budget for what and what. That is to say, if we want, it seems to me, to aim in on the Christian response to the fact that we're going to be spending $1 trillion, estimated, in the next 5 years on defense, let's just assume that that's all for the purposes of conversation, not the result of wily defense contractors, but simply that we're spending it on weapons or people to man them. And given that, or given that a large portion of that goes to that purpose, what's the Christian perspective on it, and how do you respond to it? Other, yeah.
I just had a question, kind of based on what you just said. Do you think it would be defensible at all to say that perhaps a push for reinstitution of a draft in the future may partly be justified on the basis of trying to hold down costs?
I think it would be very difficult at this stage to roll back amounts paid to people in the military, which is responsive to your question. If you bring them in one way or the other, they're not going to say, if you're brought in by draft, we'll cut your salary, or we'll cut salaries across the board, because that would absolutely decimate the volunteer of the military as such. So that, in direct response to that question, I don't think that would reduce cost of material.
Yes.
I was wondering, can we use the same argument for defense as we can for police work? On a smaller scale, we're still fighting, hopefully, evil. Not only evil within the nations, but in the communities, within ourselves.
Question. Did everybody hear the question? Would the same arguments pertain, that we would, same reflection, same understandings that we would bring to bear on the defense budget apply to local budgets, state and local budgets for law enforcement agencies, police?
I can once in a while look at that.
Sure, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. It seems like part of the answer to your questionnaire is we talk about defense, and then the question comes up, what constitutes adequate defense? What constitutes a defense of our country or a defense force? And it seems to me in the arms race, what we can destroy the world, what, 6 times or 10 times or whatever times it is, more than once, I know, I've heard anyway, with what we have now. So, there may be some justification, even from a Christian standpoint, for a defense to fight a Hitler or to fight evil or whatever, but what, how much is enough? Where does it...
Mary, I think part of the technical answer to that kind of thing is when they say, look, we have enough weaponry right now in the United States so that if you could just turn loose it and do it selectively, you could not only kill everybody in the world, but you have enough to do it 2 or 3 times, or get estimates of numbers that are even larger than that. People who say, yes, that's the case, but we still must spend more money to keep up with the state of the art, if you will, say it in effect this way. They say, look, that's true as of this minute, but our enemies, or potential enemies, the Russians, are working on intercontinental ballistic missiles that instead of taking so many minutes to get here, will take so many fewer minutes to get here. Coupled with that, their guidance systems are now of such a nature that instead of just spraying in a shotgun fashion, they can deer rifle in. Their detection methods are such that they can find exactly where it is that we have our missiles, and so therefore, even though technically we have those missiles now, Russia will, in X period of time, be in a position that she can, with the first strike, absolutely immobilize them, neutralize them, and we're then in a position where we have nothing. So therefore, we must spend money to increase our capacities to hide, to detect, to increase the the blast potential, to get our guidance systems even more, and on and on and on and on that goes, you see. They're not saying, look, we can do it 4 times already, so let's get, so we do it 6 times, so we do it 27 times.
No.
That's not the argument, you see. Their argument is, we must keep on throwing away the old. It's become obsolescent. It's become obsolete. And we must put something new.
If we spend $150 billion in one fiscal year on armament, what do we spend on peace?
What do we spend on what?
Well, what do we spend on efforts to establish peace?
You talk to some of the military, the question is, what do we spend on peace? You talk to some members of the military, and they say most of that $150 billion. This is relevant to the situation. The reverse side of the question was asked about the police forces. They say that's the only way you get peace. You keep it under control. You get peace with a balance of power. Who's a European historian?
Let me rephrase the question. Is there any organized governmental effort to create or establish some sort of a basis on which we can arrive at a peaceful disarmament in the world?
Yes, there is there's a disarmament agency in the government that, if you will, I'm trying to be objective, but let me be subjective, which is woefully underfunded, which is a token funding compared to this kind of thing, but there is such an agency. The State Department would indicate that it is principally engaged not only in commerce between nations and relationship between nations, but in being sure that we have peace, that we have allies, that we do all sorts of things, so that they would say most of these dollars are spent for this purpose. But I think that there are holes that you could punch in that. The thing that Mark made reference to, which is very interesting, and say just a word about, and that is the hearings that were involved at the present time. The Congress, at the last year, the last Congress, created a commission, 9 people. 3 were appointed by President Carter, 3 by the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and 3 by the President Pro Tem of the Senate. The 9 of us are charged with the responsibility. I am one of those who was appointed by the President Pro Tem of the Senate. The 9 of us are charged with the responsibility, within 1 year from the time we began, to come back to the President and to the Congress with recommendations about the establishment of some kind of an academy for peace and conflict resolution. And we've been holding hearings all over the States. We've gone everywhere from Los Angeles to Portland, Oregon, to Tallahassee, Florida, to New York City, to Chicago, to place after place, and getting the input. And I would welcome, frankly, as a member of that commission, we're right in the middle of, we're just about 6 months through our term of the year. We must have our report in. We're shooting for the middle part of December to get our report in, with a recommendation as to what should be done. And I would ask you, as relevant to that, that here we're spending a pittance on that compared to the kind of figures of which we're speaking.
Yes.
I'd welcome it.
Is this an international, would this make a difference internationally then? Would it be a commission that would take these recommendations internationally and try to work something out, some kind of a negotiations or an agreement?
We're not talking in terms, you see, the commission, as appointed, has a limited life. It will die at the end of its year. It is not itself to be a negotiating instrument in any wise. It is to look at the field of peace and say, should the United States, which has all the academies of which we know, military academies, and which is spending this kind of money on defense, should it do something targeted directly at peace, set up some kind of an academy? Maybe graduate school, maybe undergraduate school, maybe in a physical location, maybe not in one physical range, maybe an extension system, maybe doing a whole series of different kinds of things. We're not limited as to what it is that we should recommend to them. But our question is, should the United States be trying to do something to take the body of knowledge and spread it?
Okay.
It seems to me that I keep hearing that we have to keep spending more in defense because the Russians are spending more and we have to keep up with them. And we have the SALT talks trying to come to some kind of agreement. It seems to me that we can't because there's a lack of trust between the Soviets and us. And I'd like to hear people's thoughts about, can that trust ever be established and what can Christians do to help? It seems to me that that trust is necessary if we're ever going to come to agreements about that. I'd like to hear people's thoughts on that.
Okay, the gentleman there. Yes.
Well, I just wondered, what's the consensus of all your meetings through the first 6 months out of the 12 months at this point?
We'll give you a preview. At the last meeting, we came to the conclusion, the commission sat down and spent most of the day debating all the hearings we had and the testimony that had been received and the inputs and our own thinking. And we are going to recommend the creation of the United States Academy of Peace. There's still a number of details that we're working out as to what we would recommend it should take in the way of form. But essentially, it is, it's going to be aimed at doing research. It's going to be aimed at doing some kinds of teaching and training. And we are working on specific recommendations beyond that. But we've come to the conclusion, this commission of nine people, that there must be steps taken by the United States in this particular regard. They will be valuable as a symbol, as an instrument, that might say something about what the United States wants to do in this particular area. We don't expect it to be a panacea, but we are going to make a recommendation that will take some form, and we hope the Congress and President will act.
Yes.
In regard to this this academy that you are planning to establish or establish, hasn't a commission already been established, the Willie Brown Commission? And haven't they already asked these questions about what constitutes peace and even made recommendations about what perhaps nations should do?
There's been a reasonable amount done internationally. There is an International Academy of Peace, which is situated in New York at the present time, which is not a United States Academy. It's an academy that is under the leadership or aegis of a number of the nations which are involved in the United Nations. They're doing selective work in given areas, and what they're doing, I think, is valuable. There are certain other international things which have taken place. The Swedes have done some things in this particular area. They're talking about putting such an academy into being at the present time in Costa Rica. And there is some talk and some research work in Europe. So that there are other international steps that are being taken in this particular regard. These are not in any wise contradictory or in conflict with what it is we're thinking in terms of. We're saying that this United States of ours, which is so deeply involved in the instrumentalities of killing and war, and has an Air Force Academy and an Army Academy and a Naval Academy and a Merchant Marine Academy, series of things, plus a series of other technical graduate schools, that it should also be trying to both do research into how you bring about peace and also trying to take the body of knowledge which is already in existence and put it in a form where it can be communicated to people in the government of the United States and in the business community of the United States and in other instruments of the United States in a way that will make it useful for them and be at least a limited step in the direction of peace. That's very simplistic on the basis of 12 hearings and 6 months of work so far.
I don't know what's happening exactly. I think I've heard a lot of interesting questions and responses back and forth about facts and some tentative suggestions put forward, but I haven't heard anybody speak to the question that John Dellenbach asked at the end of his opening statement, which is, What do you as Christians make of this whole situation or any aspect of it, and what's your position on it and what you think ought to be your position on it from that standpoint? I haven't heard anybody answer that question. Now someone's going to answer it.
I feel I've often tried to get my Congress representative to vote against the budget for the defense because I feel that if enough people would do that and it would be voted down, we have to spend money on defense, and I think something would happen then, in the sense of if something got defeated, then they'd have to come together and say, look, if we can't pass that, then we're going to have to do some cuts and come to some consensus about where our priorities are in America. And I personally would want my Congress representative to do that, and I worked for a woman who did that often, and I just felt, I really was proud of her that she could say, we don't have to spend all that money, I think we have to spend some. And that's how I think this should go.
But you still would fall within the classification of those who say some money should be spent.
Oh, yeah, I think that's unrealistic to say we can't spend any money. But I think that if the defense budget got defeated, then Congress and the president would have to come to some agreements about where our priorities are in America.
In China, or in Russia, they say let's pass a law to eliminate Christianity. But we will have superiority in arms. Do we want Christianity eliminated in the United States?
Yes.
We seem to be focusing in one direction, and that is that it's kind of given that we can never eliminate all spending for defense. And so the question underlying that, which I would like to explore and hear people's suggestions, is have we ever thought, and would you take a moment to think about, exactly what it is that you fear? What is it that I fear will happen in concrete terms if, for instance, we don't spend any money for defense? I mean, let's imagine for a moment that we don't spend any money for defense, and assuming the worst, that the Russians just simply think, well, that's really neat, and they just sort of waltz in, and the distinction between the United States and Russia is gone. In concrete terms, what is it about that we fear? Is it that our pleasure boats are no longer available to us? Is it that we're not sure our children would be free to get the kind of education they want? Is it that we feel a physical threat that we'll be sent off to concentration camps? And I wonder exactly what those fears are that we always seem to take for granted when we talk about the monolithic Russians who are going to invade and take us over. What is it? And then if we know what it is, can we put that in some kind of scale, on some kind of scale, and say, what price is worth the availability of my pleasure boat? Am I willing to defend with lethal force for the right to use my pleasure boat? Is that a way to go?
Okay, number of, yes.
I don't have an answer to that question, but I have this pet theory that I don't really believe that Russia or any country would be able to control that much land and that many people. And I just wonder if anybody else has had that thought.
Yes.
I've been listening here, and I'm thinking of myself. I live in Sweden, and we are very close to Russia. You can take your own boat if you have a big one, enough, and go straight over to the Baltic States, and there you are. And people never in Sweden speak about fear that way that I can hear here. And I'm wondering if it is the distance and the lack of information that the distance creates more fear. I have a feeling that neither the American people nor the Russian people want this fear, because as far as I can understand, I was in Moscow in March, the Russians are as afraid of the Americans as you are the Russians. And I wonder if it's not a situation that has been so fit, because nothing to do about that.
No, there's no hand up, right? Okay, now there is.
We have 30 seconds. The men at the top, they have gotten to an angle where prestige is what decides. And if just, it could be found some kind of formula to release the pressure of this prestige so that they could get out of talking again. I think the whole building up of this situation would change. I'd like to know what you think about it.
Okay, tell me.
Well, if Russia actually came waltzing over here, he wouldn't be sitting here having meetings like this, that's for sure. He wouldn't be talking against the government freely.
Yes?
He'd be in bondage as the Russians themselves are.
And when Marty started talking, I really have in the discussion, you know, a lot of talk like this is being done here, and I really thought, well, what would happen if we just, you know, gave up? And first of all, I kind of agree with the woman that said she wonders if any country could control, I don't know how many, 280 million people that we have, 300 million or something. But in just sort of a flippant way, I mean, I know this is very naive and very sort of, but I just sometimes think what a ball we could have in sabotaging and just a sense of humor. If a Russian force came in, I mean, I think the American people could just have, just go wild with all kinds of goofy stuff. That's very naive and very
young. Yes,
yeah, exactly
that.
Yeah, through the coaching of wrestling, I've come in contact with a man that grew up, was born in the Soviet Union, and is now in America. He was the fifth best Greco-Roman wrestler in the Soviet Union, and he was in international competition until he lost once. And then they didn't let him out of the country again. He happened to be able to get a sponsorship and go through the paperwork and was fortunate enough to come to the United States. I spent some time talking to him. And he has told us several things about the Soviet Union and the things that have happened there to him personally. He said, and in his own words, that negotiations are no good for the Soviet Union. He said 10% of the people in there are communistic, and those 10% of the people run the country, and those 10% of the people cannot be trusted. And those are his words. He was a citizen of the Soviet Union, and I don't know how much clearer you can get. A pair of jeans, a lot of people are wearing them, $200 for a pair. Can you pay that? You want to get married? You get married, and you get taxicab. You get a taxi cab, and they take you on a tour of the museums and the statues for your honeymoon. That would be fun. Wait 3 years for an apartment. Live with your folks while you do.
Okay, this gentleman here we haven't heard from.
Well, I think you got to, in response to the young lady up there, I think you got to be careful because, first of all, they probably wouldn't concentrate on the older people. They'd concentrate on the younger people and bringing them up in the way they want to, through their schools and through their training and everything else. They would rule with fear. I mean, I believe they have no fear, and I think it's proven in Afghanistan, of taking a bunch of you out in front of a bunch of people and mow you down, and that's it. And they're not going to concentrate on the older group. They're going to concentrate on the group that they can educate and bring them up and finally bring them around to their way. Like this young gentleman says, 10% of them rule the nation. That is basically, I think, even bigger than ours.
Yes.
I personally don't fear that the Russians are going to go over here and ruin our country because I feel by the time that would happen, there wouldn't be much left of America anyhow, and I suspect my greatest fear is that we're just going to annihilate the whole world, and that's my fear.
Yes.
U.S. News and World Report has an interesting two-page survey in the latest issue. That's a fairly conservative business-oriented magazine, and the question from the Russian expert who works for that magazine is whether or not Russia will survive another 5 years in its present state. He believes there's at least a 50-50 chance that there's about to be a tremendous revolt among the working class over there. And I really believe that somewhere in Russia this discussion can go on. It's not as widely publicized, I guess. But I think there is our people talking over there. And I have a sense that there's kind of an invisible shield that if we could get past, we'd find out how darn ordinary, how darn human we really are on both sides of this curtain, and that we're working out of an irrational fear, maybe based on distance or lack of knowledge, that I don't know. I guess the way I'm going to handle it in a concrete terms is that I'm going to send letters to my senator now saying, please, dear Mr. Gravel and Mr. Stevens, I don't want you to defend me anymore. Please don't. Please don't kill anybody, please. So in all your speeches now, please say, I'm working for the defense of America, except for Mr. Wells. I defend it.
I agree. I think I find it kind of difficult to believe, as it seems that we all kind of a common understanding, underlying assumption, that there is an irreconcilable clash between the interests of the Soviet Union as a nation or as a people and the interests of the United States. And that if we believe that assumption, then naturally, at some point, we'll reach a conflict, or at least some continued Cold War conflict, and it leads to kind of an inbred war psychology that we have. And it seems that there has to be some way that we can see that at least, maybe if we can't believe we can trust them totally, or they can't believe they can trust us totally, there has to be some way that we can try to work for a mutual advantage, which would help to alleviate some of the pressures between nations.
Well, I could go in another direction. I guess I'm thinking about the film we saw, Excuse Me, America, where someone said, we're so caught up in our East and West, we have to realize the real issues between the North and the South, the people who have and the people who have not, the people who are eating and the people who are hungry, and where does the money go, and where does the involvement go, and where does the commitment go? And maybe it has to be re-examined. Maybe it's more important to feed people than it is to be afraid.
Yeah. I'd like to try a little experiment. Put your hand up. That if I push, you push initially. And if you relax, I'll relax. And we can move apart with a degree of comfort. Perhaps this is something that we can do between nations. We can pull back, we can relax and move back away from each other and take some of the tensions out. I'm always reminded of the actions that are being taken in Europe right now. The maintenance of our military force over there, rockets up against the German-Russian border. Perhaps if we move back, they in turn would move back gradually. Relaxation, I think it's possible.
Yeah.
I think that just from what's happened in the past so many times, and like he says, there's only a 10% that are running that country, and maybe the people are like us inside, but they are running it, and from what they've done in the past, it's going to happen again. And we fought so long for our religious freedom over here that it would just be going backwards to just knock off all defenses and just let whatever happens, Russia come in because of our fear. We fought so long, I think, for what we believe in as Christians, and they don't, and they wouldn't let us if they could control us that way. That 10%. The revolt sounds like a good hope, it seems like, if they can get past their 10%. And our freedom, trying to get the schools going for peace over the country, rather than just dropping our defenses against Russia and just letting them come over here, doesn't seem like an answer.
Yes, sir. Historically, has an arms race ever ended in peace? You're a historian,
I can't think of one right offhand.
It always ends in war, right? You don't build those airplanes to not bomb people.
That's right. Now there was a gentleman, yes,
sort of in response to your idea of taking force back, earlier there was a question of trust. It seems like if we talk about trust between individuals, you only establish trust if you, first of all, trust the other person. And then you develop trust. The question is, are you going to be willing to let yourself be vulnerable to do that? And it seems that is what we're going to have to be called upon to do if we want to establish trust, is to make ourselves vulnerable. And as far as the Christian aspect, it seems like something of what Marty, I think, is trying to get at. As Christians, are we going to let our fears of losing things prevent us from becoming vulnerable? Or do we have something else that maybe can allow us to become vulnerable, willing to accept the fact that we may lose all these things, and see what happens then?
Okay, before calling on it, is anybody up here who's had their hand up that I've not noticed?
Yes.
Oh, there is somebody up there? Oh, I can't see behind the belt. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's rather interesting how difficult it is for us to zero in on what I can do. We're third-personing almost everything tonight, and I guess I'm in that camp too. But I think we have a very serious attitudinal problem in our country, and part of that is a mystique of war. Part of it is an ignorance of the incredible destructibility of the weapon systems that we have created. And I think as Christian people, we have to begin addressing that and bringing a degree of realism into the picture. I'm not entirely clear as to how to go about that, but I think we have to start challenging some of the propaganda that we're being fed by the Pentagon. I think we have to start challenging the power of Joint Chiefs of Staff, which you could argue are more powerful than the President of the United States. I think we have to start teaching and speaking and promoting peace. I personally don't believe that peace comes ever by preparing for war. And I've tried to find in history too an evidence where that's worked, and I have yet to come up with one. However, whenever you try to argue that, you can't get too far, because the answer comes back, well, we aren't in war now. So the delicate detente that seems to be faltering may have worked to some degree.
Yeah.
To answer Marty's question about the things that we fear losing, I think that from a worldwide perspective, that I think our fears are primarily economic. The United States depends on, say, the Mideast for our supplies of oil. And were we to lose those supplies from a military standpoint, economically, we could probably not survive. From a home front point of view, I think the fears that we have are losing the things perhaps that are stated in the Bill of Rights, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, women's rights are not there yet, but they're working on them. These are the things that I think that we fear losing, and that we have in the past felt are worth defending. Now, last night we discussed the Christians'
20 seconds.
Attitude toward being a Christian soldier, and I think that if we're to take the theoretical or the Christian's way with regards to the military, in the same way that we took the Christian soldier, that we can't support it. But it sounds to me like from the consensus here that we have to reach a compromise rather than completely withdraw support.
Yes.
The last three or four minutes this morning in the Bible study, Bruce touched on something that I think really answers the question from a Christian standpoint. And I hope I can quote him correctly, but he's up there if I don't. He said something to the effect that if we as Christians don't dream the dreams of peace and solving hunger in the world, who will? Who in the world will? If we as Christians don't have these aspirations and these dreams and don't strive to do our level best to see that they're accomplished, who else will? Yes.
In response to that,
in response to the fears that we have of not being able to sit in a room like this and have a free conversation, not to be able to worship freely, not to be able to do this or that or the other thing. I think, again, as Christians, we're in a unique situation of being able to snub our nose at all of that and say, who cares? You know, if we die, if we're killed, I mean, I'm being naive, but as Christians, we have to be naive, and we know that the end is not in this world, and that one of the lines from the Beatitudes last night, it really hit me. It's blessed are the, let's see, it was the one that said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, and I never knew what that meant. But in the LBW, they said, who hunger and thirst that right might prevail. And that really hit me strong.
What is it you're suggesting take part?
Well, I'm suggesting that we must not be paralyzed by fear, as Marty is saying, about specific things that might happen. We might have to pay $10 for quarantines. We might have to, I don't know.
Are you suggesting that there's no defense against any other nation?
No.
There should be no other?
I can't suggest that. But I do feel that we have to eliminate, somehow get rid of our fear of whatever this is.
Yes, go in behind the pole there.
I think something to remember is not for ourselves, but for the generations after us. You know, it's easy to say for us that when we do die, we will go to heaven with God, but our children might be left, and what will happen to them? And I think we have to remember that.
Yes, the woman in the green.
Well, do we want a complete change in our government, you know, from the type that we have now to a complete communist-controlled government?
There's no
evidence.
That
would change the whole country, everything.
There's no proof that the Russians wouldn't negotiate a lasting disarmament peace. There's no proof of that. We've got 100 years of failure of armaments, races, and wars, and there's no proof that if we sincerely went after a solution to peace that we wouldn't get it. Granted, there's a lot of risk involved, but there is absolutely no proof that it wouldn't work if it were threatened. Yes.
Is there anyone in this room that doubts? Is there anyone in this room that believes that someone could tell you not to be a Christian and you would have to do it? Is there anyone here who doesn't think somehow they could pass the faith on to their children, even if they were living in a communist country? And if you don't buy those, is there anyone here who doesn't think we have a God of history who has been with people in exile before and who, while they were in exile, told those people to pray for the land they lived in during their exile? I don't think the law, even in jurisprudence, there's no such thing as a mandatory injunction. They can't make you do something that you don't want to do. An opera singer cannot be made to sing opera. Well, we just can't do it. And I'm saying, how can I be stopped from being a Christian? What can they do to me?
Jim?
It was sometime toward the end of the Vietnam War, there was an infamous interview conducted by some news media people with a group of soldiers, Air Force, I think, who had received orders to bomb a village. And they did that. And then afterwards they just leveled the place. And afterwards they were interviewed and they said, well, their instructions were to level that in order that they could save it. And where the arms race is going on here, and the armaments are building up, and we're convinced that the only way we'll save democracy is by blowing the whole world up, like that village in Vietnam. And We're just crazy. We're just nuts.
Okay, back to...
In respect to this gentleman's question or comment over here, do you have any young children?
No.
I've got a 2-year-old daughter. I know that if I was caught, say, practicing a religion in a country where that religion was not accepted, and they took me away and killed me, and took my daughter and put her in a special school, that she would not learn Christianity in that special school after they had burned the Bibles, after they had gotten rid of all the religious teachings and everything else. You answered for me where she's going to learn the religion. Where is she going to learn Christianity? Now, hopefully the Spirit will intervene, but the old saying that the farmer's field does not produce a crop without the farmer working hard, I think is oftentimes true. Could you respond to that, please?
Could you respond to it? Over here.
We'd like him to respond to that question.
In talking to two Polish priests who were missionaries in Africa, found out that, I didn't know this before, I thought Poland must really be a terrible place to live because of the communist rule, so to speak. And it isn't all that nice from what they say. But one thing they did say is the church is so alive they can't even contain the people. They have 7 masses a Sunday, baptisms all over the place, communist officials, behind the scenes of course, asking for the children to be baptized and getting them baptized. And one thing bad about it, they can't build any more churches. But the churches are packed. And the Pope is from Poland. So.
Yes.
Yes, I would just like to stress what Jenny just said. There are lots of Christians in Russia, and the churches are open. The churches work, and the congregations work and function. People get together. And I think that fear is a greater threat to democracy.
Yes, sir.
Why do people want to escape from Russia and they won't let them escape? You don't find people escaping into Russia. There must be a reason.
Go ahead.
I think that this is because there's something else. And that is, for instance, freedom of speech, which I think is very important.
Okay.
There's another point to it too. And that is that there is sometimes shortage of food. And that means a lot to
people. Pretty bad.
Yes?
Well, sometimes I get very mixed up in all this, but I keep saying to myself, I have a child, now older than 2. Am I worried so much that he would be put into a special school and retaught another way of life? Or am I worried that the way of life that I'm teaching him isn't teaching him the right thing anyway, because I'm supporting the mass destruction of human beings, because I know I have not much control over a nuclear war? Am I teaching him the wrong thing anyway?
I'm going to take 2 more comments and then let those who want to leave, leave.
Bruce
and then... Okay. Bruce first, and then the gentleman in the green sweater. First, Bruce. Yeah.
I have a couple of children. I don't worry at all that my children will ever grow up under a communist government. I think that's the wildest herring and the rabbit in the hat in this kind of discussion. I don't believe. I'm much more fearful that he's going to end. That he and she are going to end up incinerated in a nuclear war. I think that's a much more real possibility. The reason I don't worry about living under a communist government is because I have no thought in my mind that we would ever choose to so live. I don't believe that we have the option of sort of giving up all defense. Most people seem to agree that we need to have some defense. What I would like to see happen is stop spending money on additional defense and escalating the arms race. At the present state, I think no matter what the change in the technological state of the art, that this country could not be conquered without destroying it. And I think one of the things that I haven't heard in this discussion is the fact that we and the Russians and every other nation on the earth are living in an increasingly mutually interdependent world. Even if we disarmed unilaterally, did away with every nuclear warhead we have, and then we're blown off the face of the earth, I don't think even if not a single nuclear bomb fell on Russia, I don't think that world would be much good to live in for the Russians any more than it would for anyone else left. About 60% of the exportable food in the world comes from here, and the Russians are buying more of it than anyone else.
How many minutes?
There's a tremendous complex interdependence in the international community, which will make it impossible, I think, for that kind of conquest sort of military operation that we tend to think of in the past. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think, particularly when we recently read that there were 3 successive computer malfunctions indicating a Russian attack, I do think we're a heck of a lot closer to that kind of danger than we are to any kind of an imaginary scenario of Russians coming in to run the American political system.